Okay, let's start today's session. Good. For the past, so I will start the recording and we will have the first presenting. Ei jos varmaan pitää nyt tuota noin niin. Mun jakaa sitten näyttö. Mä oon yleensä tehnyt sen.
Säätämisen.
Aina.
Täällä jotain jopa ihan sama hässä.
Ei.
Se on edelleen nyt on tärkeää.
Ei kun hetkinen, kato mun näyttöä. No niin.
Langan puhuttu ei mun.
Mä oon miettinyt, että pitäisi olla sellainen checklista tässä.
Niin. Tässä seuraavaksi valittaa.
Niin, olisiko nyt ei.
Toimiksen härtäkin.
Koitetaan. Eka taas tuossa vielä. Joo, nyt.
Joo, toimii.
No niin.
Mutta minun täytyy nähdä, että minä kierrän tämän.
Mä käännän
Joo,
tälleen, mikä
käännäpä
auttaa
sen.
nyt.
Joo, minä ei tarvitse tonne.
Okay, sorry for the technical issues, but Manu Lahtinen telling about his group today. So we will start with this presentation.
Yeah, okay, thank you. As we introduced, I'm Manu Lahtinen from Inorganic Chemistry discipline, and I'm a structural chemist. I had my dissertation on 2008, something like that. And from that on, I've been the senior lecturer, adjunct professor in inorganic chemistry. And I have run my group around from 2010 or something like that. It's been larger and smaller, and currently it's actually quite large. And as you can see from the following slides, I try to show a short showcase of the projects we are running in our group currently, and at the end showing some main instrumentation or methods we're using in our projects to characterize our products. And on the introduction page, there is a reason why that kind of a molecule runs there, because that is what I love. So as I'm a structural chemist, then my main expertise is a single crystal diffraction. And those are coordination cages. They are 30 angstrom large, that particular one, meaning that it's 3 nanometers and it's just a cation. So there is a huge cavity inside, and as you can see, or you can guess, what is the node? It's water. So there is six, sorry, three, it is running, three water molecules making a hexagonal node. And it crystallizes overnight for measurable synchrocrystals. But today we are not discussing about those, because those are not for circular economy. They are really fundamental science to understand the crystallization and supramolecular things. But just, I love those. And there is a link to my group pages. It's in Finnish, but it's of course in there in English. You can check that. I think I don't try to go there and going back to the presentation. Most likely, they have the demo effect.
Maybe we could put the meeting controls.
You think it works if I just click?
Yeah, you can.
Do you think I can get back?
Probably.
Probably. So I will change it in English version. So the actual group topic is named as porous materials and molecular capsules. Well, you heard of the capsule part already, but the main materials we are nowadays playing with are metal organic frameworks, and they are of course porous materials, which is the other main thing we are currently focusing. We'll be playing with MOS around 10, 12 years now. First as all kinds of a master thesis and bachelor works, but currently with real projects with it, which is funded by some foundations or European Union. And if we go down here, there are some basic knowledge here. And the group members are here. So those are currently in my group. So few postdocs, so Samu Forsblom and Janatu Ramkki are postdocs. Some of them are project researchers, and some of them are PhD students or just graduated PhD students. So Shreya Mahajan had her dissertation in mid-September, so 2 weeks ago. So she's now a doctor. So Ida, Jesse, Antti, they are PhD students, and then Tommi, Jimmy in the audience, Terhi, are project researchers in projects which I will show shortly. Okay, how I go back? Think I just need to go. There, yes. Okay, so first project is funded by Regional Council of Central Finland, meaning that it's a European Union funded project. It started already on March 23, and it actually is ending on next April 25. It's roughly a 700,000 euro project, including development and investment. And what is the focus of this project is to find a new extraction recovery methods for critical elements. And we selected as the material to look at are the LEDs, so light emitting diodes. We have them nowadays everywhere, except in our university with all halogen lamps. But world will be full of used LEDs really soon. As we all know, there are elements which are crucial for the function of the LED, but at the same time, they are critical elements. And we focused on in this project particularly for gold and gallium. Of course, there's a reason for those. They are particularly gold is rather expensive element. And the gallium is kind of critical. There is actually a bug. Gold is not a rare earth metal. Well, I have quickly edited something and it should be in a different order. But anyway, so that's one thing we're doing in this project. So trying to find hydrometallurgical ways to get the elements separated from those LEDs, and finally then they can be used to something else or recycled. And it's a rather challenging task For the reason that if you think that the LEDs are just a small part, the chip itself is just a small part of the actual lamp or bulb. So there is a lot of aluminum. And why there's a lot of aluminum is that it's a kind of a cheap metal. It acts like a heat sink and it's easy to cast, etc. So most of the bulb body structures are aluminum. And there is also a lot of copper. So finding the proper ways to separate all these elements with really magnitudinal differences in their quantity is challenging. So you need pre-treatments to make things work. But we are currently doing that, and the first publication is currently in a manuscript draft phase, I can say. So most likely we can submit the paper before end of the year. And we are also focusing to a few other things, which you can see there. There is actually interesting collaboration with one Finnish company. It's called Lapa Recycling. It's a company which changes wind turbines, those huge turbine blades, as you can see around Finland and of course all around Europe. At some point, they age, they have to be changed, or they break during storms, etc. And one blade can weigh something like from 20 to 30 tons. It's a composite, it contains a lot of glass wool, all kind of composite resins, but also metals, even wood. It's really complicated material and really hard. So currently we are characterizing what it actually contains. Is there any such quantities of elements which can be extracted, dissolved, or somehow taken before they are finally going to the dump site, or they will be burned, or whatever the final treatment is for those blades? So that's quite interesting collaboration. And we are also characterizing the carbonate pyrolysis waste. There is one company in Tampere, Waste, I'm not certain whether it's in Tampere, but it's called WasteWise. They pyrolyze plastics, all kinds of plastic, usually used plastics, not pristine ones. And they want you to know which kind of residuals those plastic or the pyrolyzed, I call it pyrolyzed waste here, but actually it's waste because they haven't found a proper use for it yet. And before they can actually enter into active carbon markets, they have to know what it contains, whether it contains heavy metals or some hazardous components. So we're currently characterizing what it may contain. Personal in this project is there is two full-time researchers and then some part-time, so that some of the staff members are participating this project, and I'm the principal investigator of this project. And the second part of the project is actually the investment, and with this funding, we managed to procure new X-ray fluorescence spectrometer to the department. We haven't had this kind of a technique before. Well, we had some desktop-sized, really routine small instrument, which was well, it was dead already 10 years ago. And it could only characterize elements from the on a periodic table from sulfur up to higher elements. But this one is, so to speak, best on the markets. It's a wavelength dispersive It has the strongest X-ray tube which can be. So it's a 4 kilowatt tube. It's a rhodium tube. And we can characterize all the elements from beryllium to uranium. Well, plutonium, of course, also, but it's usually not something we want to characterize. Not even uranium, but maybe. And by that, we can characterize solid and liquid samples both in qualitative way, but also quantitative way. So it's an elemental analysis, which is based on that the sample is exposed to a strong X-ray beam, and per element, they emit fluorescence. And for every element, there is a characteristic, so to speak, peaks or characterized wavelengths, which indicate whether you have that element in your sample. And based on calibration, you can also get the quantity. And depending on the user skills and the quality of calibration, it can be even highly accurate for the quantity. Of course, then the measurements take more time. It has a additional feature, so-called a grid mapping, which means that we can actually characterize solid objects, not really big ones, but roughly 5 centimeter to 5 centimeter size of a solid objects. And we can make a grid, meaning that we can spot analyze the material with 100 micron accuracy. So it goes to each spot, runs the entire wavelength spectrum, and checks what elements is in that particular spot. Moves to the next spot, makes the same. So perfect use for that kind of a technique is for
drilling sample.
Those are, if the mining industry wants to build up a mine, they have to first make the samples. So they drill this stone kind of a pipes, and you can cut kind of analytes from that, small flakes or plates. And you can actually with that characterize each of the granules you see in this kind of a sample, pinpoint where is the maybe the copper ore or a nickel ore, etc. So it's really useful for that kind of analysis. And this instrumentation is particularly obtained to department in by thinking that we can later on have a service type of a research collaboration analysis with the industry. And we already have received some interest from the industry side because this is quite expensive instrument, meaning that is 300,000 over 300,000 euro instrument. So even in industry, not every company has money to buy this kind of instrumentation, even though they would like to have or they actually need that kind of analysis. So that's major part of the investment. And then in this project, there is a small portion of an idea that because this kind of an instrumentation produces a lot of data, we have a lot of Excel sheets after one measurement. It gives all kind of information. So there is a small portion of the project to plan a kind of a digital data bank where you can actually log in and get kind of at least a qualitative information of certain type of materials characterized, what they may contain. But it's not a major part. And in this project, we have a stakeholders, so all of those have given some money to our project. So there is a local company, Alma, is producing the water for Jyväskylä city and the heat. So there is two power plants, of Alva company. One is in Rauhalahti and one is in Kerjola. Quite big plants where they actually burn nowadays wood. Business Jyväskylä is Jyväskylä city is this kind of section which takes care of business between Jyväskylä and surrounding companies. Äänekosken kehitys is actually Äänekoski is nearby town where is a big pulp mill and it's related to that. Refiner is actually originating from Department of Chemistry. So it's a small company which makes all kinds of filters for extracting metals from solutions, and they use 3D printing technology. So they make 3D printed filters, so-called scavengers or 4D scavengers, I think is the, but you can go to WeFinders website to see more information. Okay, time runs. I finished many more. Okay, then next project. It's a collaboration project with VGT, which is a national research center, partly government owned. It's a quite big institution. And well, the title tells more or less everything. So it's a project, 2-year project, started January this year, ends end of 25. Our share is roughly half a million. VGT have the same amount, roughly half a million, so it's a 1 million project for 2 years. And our part is to find proper storage materials for hydrogen. Solid porous materials where we could store hydrogen. Instead of storing hydrogen in high pressure containers or cylinders. Because the density of hydrogen is so low that it needs to be compressed to over 200 and up to 700 bars before it's reasonable to even transfer to one place to another. And it likes to diffuse through even metals. So it's a little bit complicated element. So our job is to find whether hydrogen can be stored, surprise, metal organic frameworks. And we're not the pioneers on that. Already in 95, when MOFS was launched or kind of introduced to broader scientific society by Umar Yaki, US, the first study was to use these to storage in hydrogen. So we are kind of looping back. There are evidence that actually these can be rather good materials for it, but of course it needs to be examined and of course then fine-tuned and developed more. So the VGT side is to focus the production of hydrogen. So they have developed this kind of a membrane-based electrolyzers. In this case, an anion exchange membrane type of electrolyzers for maybe 20 years by combining more traditional PEM technique to this anion exchange technique. So PEM means just a proton exchange membrane. Any membrane which can access by protons to both sides and blocking all the other ions. But this is a special kind of a task-specific development of this anion exchange membrane type. So they develop electrolyzers, and we try to develop ways to store the hydrogen they produce. And also on VGT, they have an office in Jyväskylä, or a site. It's not just an office. They are building up a hydrogen storage testing rig, so where we actually can test our morphs in pressurized cell and check. They can then measure how large or high quantities of hydrogen it can uptake and in what pressure conditions and in what temperature conditions, and how the hydrogen can be released on from these materials. Because if they are storage materials, they have to work on both ways. So they need to be some affinity to get the hydrogen in, but there should not be too strong contact so that we can actually get the hydrogen out. We didn't focus only on MOFs. Oh, sorry, yeah, on one slide. But we took a second approach, which is a porous biocarbon. We know that carbon itself has an affinity to hydrogen. So idea of that part is to be look for localized biomass sources, whether they are side stream or waste streams. Sawdust, for example, pine sawdust is actually what we're using now. So we are pyrolyzing it in 1300 degrees for a few hours, and we actually can produce biocarbon. And there are ways to improve the porosity of biocarbon by certain treatments, chemical or by temperature, etc. So partly oxidizing, for example. And we will test what is the capacities of that material. And then we have a third group, which is also porous. I'm pretty sure that everyone has encountered cheolites in your washing powder when you make laundry. Nowadays, there are cheolites. So they have similar, well, similar structure than MOFs, but they are fully inorganic. So they are aluminosilicates. So we're actually testing whether the hydrogen can be stored in that, and particularly for used cheolites. So in Finland, there is a Neste company, which is an oil production company. It makes petrols, benzenes, all kinds of oils. And they use zeolite as a catalyst in their big cracking columns, hydrogenation towers. So we have some few hundred grams of their zeolite, which is already used in their columns. And when it's not catalytically active in their process, it goes to the downside. But we would like to test whether it still has some porous capacity left and whether it can be used as a storage material for hydrogen. We will see. No one has tested that before. So in that, we are pioneers. Next case. So another consortium joint project with VGT, it's called abbreviation is BitGain. There is a website, actually. I think there was also a website for the previous one. Unfortunately, I think for BitGain, it's only Finnish. I don't understand why, but because this is coordinated by VGT, it was their call. So this is a little bit different funding. It's a just transition fund, but still from EU. Started last year. Ends next year, ending roughly our part is roughly million. VGT part is roughly million. So this is almost 2 million euro project for two and a half years. So this is for energy size. So we are examining redox flow batteries. And particularly there, so I think this has important to be like, yeah. Good. So we are actually studying this. It's a vanadium redox flow battery. And it's an alternative for lithium-ion batteries. There are many advantages on this, but of course there are downsides, like in case of lithium-ion batteries. These won't burn. Lithium-ion batteries burn, we know that. By charging, they can burn easily. If there's any leakage between the cathode and anode side. The function of this battery is simple. We have two tanks. You can think that there's a plus tank with a minus tank. So there's two solutions. And then you have the electrodes. Of course, there are a lot of all kinds of plates, metal, insulator, etc. But there is a membrane in the middle. Then you have electrodes. Then you have, of course, you need to have some pumps so that your solution runs, flows. It goes to the electrode, same on this side. And then we have a membrane. It's that so-called proton exchange membrane. So that membrane separates these two sides. It allows transfer of protons which carry the charge. So that when we charge this system, it goes one way, and when we run the battery, it goes another way. But always the charge is just transferred with the proton. These are usually strongly acidic. They are sulfur acid based liquids, and then we use the vanadium and its several valence states playing with the redox. So the vanadium goes all the way from +5 to +2, depending on which side it exists. So VGG actually bought already commercial version of this. So it's a 10 kilowatt testing site. We also bought this from a commercial company, and I think our version is 10 watts. Our electrode is 2.5 centimeter on side by side. But we can't build up membranes of 0.5 meter size, so it's too expensive. So we bought our miniature flow redox flow battery, and the VGT bought a real one. On VGT side, the idea is that they actually join the redox battery with solar panels. So when the solar panels produce a lot of energy, they pack it into the redox battery. When there is a shortage of electricity, meaning that electricity is high priced, it can be run from the battery to the national network. That's the idea, of course, which they are testing. Is it commercially feasible or not? And what it needs for balancing the speeds and flows, etc. But we try to just develop this thing, and particularly one other group, Matti Hauppas' group, is actually playing with the electrodes. So they will develop better biocarbon-based electrodes. They actually try to make graphite from biomass. We succeeded already. We can create graphite and much lower temperatures than the literature says. So we are in a good side on that. And in micro, we try to do something with the membrane. Currently, this membrane, which is in between of these two electrodes, is a polyfluorinated organic polymer. And European Union has already made some preliminary decisions that some of the polyfluorinated polymers are abandoned maybe in next 5 years. So what happens to these membranes? if certain materials are not available anymore. So we took a bold step and we tried to make a biocarbon from chitosan. And that is a dense film, so we need some ports for the protons to transfer from both sides. Again, we use metal organic frameworks. They are porous materials. They can be built up so that water goes in and out, but nothing else. So we make a hybrid material. So we mix these two, the membranes and the mass, and then we have a certain dispersion of proton exchangeable pores. So the water goes through these, not the membrane film itself. Okay, I think I need to move on. This is already completed one. This is from Academy of Finland, which I was granted 2020. It's a carbon capture. This is the topic Shreya had his dissertation just 2 weeks ago. We had full publication on that. Idea in here was more develop new MOF types from certain building units. So the MOFs are simply, as they are metal organic frameworks, they are metal knotted so that there are organic ligands which have at least two binding points. Quite often carboxylic acids or tertiary amines, which can bind with a coordinated bond, so the dative bond, quite often transition metal. And they, in the best case scenario, they form three-dimensional periodic highly crystalline materials where all the channels and voids are equally the same because it's a crystal symmetry. And for example, in this case, here the mouth is empty. It's exposed to CO2. The CO2 locks into the pore of the mouth. There is one other example. And in this project, it was consortium with VTT, JYU, and Lappeenranta University of Technology. So there's three different groups. Well, actually, there's more groups even in a loop. But we did the MOF part. We tested a little bit some coating techniques, how to introduce these MOF powders to certain materials to get more like a kind of a working unit and not just an active powder or powder, but really trying to set it on some surfaces. We tested metal plates, we tested a cordierite, and actually the ceramic system worked best. Quickly forward and one PhD project. So Antti Marttinen is testing whether green hydrogen can be prepared just with the photocatalytic way. Just splitting the water with MOF network, which acts at the same time as a light scavenger, but catalyst to break the bond, create oxygen and hydrogen. And here are a few of the MOF structure from that, and some solid-state UV-less spectra to show the absorption properties of these materials. And we particularly try to find materials which absorb light on a visible light range, because that's the major part of our spectrum which come from the sun. And all the old systems are based on UV light. And it's only some, I think 3% of the wavelengths coming from the sun are UV and rest is visible. So we really need to get this function material which will absorb broad spectrum of light to get this part working. What else? More production of hydrogen. So this was funded by the Magnus Ehrnrooth Foundation for 4 years. And the next one is actually funded by Fortum and Neste Foundation. It's a PFC project. And this is alkaline electrolysis. This is the commercial way which is used for production of hydrogen in a green way. Then the most used way is steam reformulation, where the methane is split to hydrogen and carbon, meaning that 1 kilo of hydrogen produced, it produces 11 kilos of CO2. That's the way how it's done nowadays. But if you want to make it a green way, meaning using the alkaline electrolysis and splitting the water in alkaline conditions, you need electrodes. And we are planning that we improve the electrodes with MOFs on some coated system where there is just a core unit and it's coated with MOFs. And the splitting again occurs inside the MOF pores. And also in this project, we are utilizing carbon as an electron core. And those are just the printed test tablets for this system. What's that? One more. This is funded by, well, this is actually two in the same slide. There's one Magnus Ehrnrooth Foundation and our doctoral school funded project where we try to find this kind of hybrid materials. It's a chitosan based where the MOFs are synthesized into the chitosan substrate, and it's designed for capturing arsenic species, arsenic +3 and +5. It's a big problem in certain countries that the groundwater contains a lot of arsenic. And this material is designed for capturing those, and we have already so far got a really good results. So let's see how this project goes. And then the final one, the funding is from Finnish Natural Resources Research Foundations. They are ridiculously long foundation name. And other big problem in mining industry is xanthates. They are used to capture the metals from the ore using this flocculation method. And this is highly toxic in environment, even in really small concentrations. And in that small concentration, you cannot precipitate it anymore. You cannot extract it from the wastewater. But again, we found that it actually goes into the certain types of MOF pores, stays there, and can actually also remove it, and this system can be reused. So we are designing, of course, this project is almost ending this year. This one project, we're finding again something useful or applications for MOF structures. And I think here are the methods. So obviously a lot of powder X-rays, that's the main thing to characterize bulk materials or powders. We produce a lot, even the solid objects. So the electrodes we print or for any tablets we print, we can characterize them to powder X-rays. Seeing crystals, not that much on these projects, but for example, for those coordination cages. And of course, we need X-ray fluorescence. We use a lot of thermal analysis methods, so thermogravimetry, different scanning calorimetry, We can use Evolved gas analysis, which means that we can characterize the from the thermal analysis, the evaporates, the sample produces when it's heated. We have microscopic methods. Obviously, we have a lot of printing methods. These are mostly governed by Matti Haukka's group, but we luckily can use them. It's a joint collaboration. And we have a brand new gas sorption analyzer, so PET. It's actually currently under commission, so there are test runs running, I think, currently. And it's also funded by the Just Transition Fund. And of course, we have some microscopy and proper autoclave or synthesis reactors for the MOF synthesis. And by that, I thank you.
Not that you would be 15 minutes, but
Yeah.
luckily you didn't
You
have
never
more.
know.
Are there any questions for Manu? Really interesting projects. It's
Yeah.
nice to see when you finish those what
Yeah.
kind of results you will get.
No promises. Science sometimes a little bit hard.
Yeah. I was thinking about the windmill blades. What are they currently? How are they recycled? What do they do with those? Do you
They
know?
cut them to pieces and they try to burn them, and then what is left is put in the dump site.
So not very good
No,
recycling at all.
it's not a recycling at all, actually. But the problem is size and quantity.
Yeah.
Because nowadays they are so huge and they are even growing larger. I think there are already windmills having 300 meter top height, so that the plates are 100 meters long, so that there is 100 meter kind of a safety to the crowns, making the 200 meter circle.
Yeah.
But yeah, so anyway, if you think any kind of extraction methods of those, the quantities are already so huge that. But anyway, we check how the plates can be either pre-treated, or is there any chance for any kind of a extraction by dissolving at least some part of it? But they are really complicated structures. I am seeing few parts of the wing plates. There are metal bars, there are copper wiring, there are composite films, there are carbon kind of a matrices, all kinds of things. Really complicated.
Yeah, and
So,
there is a real need to that recycling. Yes. Yeah.
certainly.
But there is no questions in the chat, so
Okay.
thank you, Manu, again. We will move on to the next
So I
present.
take my things and go for the next meeting.
I'll stop the share so I can start
Yeah.
a new share here.
But never was that.
Yes,
Okay.
kiitos. I'm not sure how this is learning.
Okay. Tuolta jonkun loistavaan
Se tämä?
taakse. Joo.
Joo, menisiköhän se
Ja
nyt
sitten full
tämä?
screen.
Mistä tässä laittaa
Kun on
sen?
pikkusen erinäköisiä. Jos painaa F1. Ei. F1.
Ainakin sinne.
No,
Jotenkin kun mä koitin sitä itse, niin se vaan automaattisesti lähti sitä vetämään.
Kyllä se tässä niin kuin vaihtaa ainakin.
No se niin paljon on, to put it full screen.
Maybe it's okay if we have it like this. Yeah, it should be
So maybe
okay.
we take F11 key. F11,
F11.
no. Or should I put F? Yep.
Ah, thank
Well,
you. Yes. Great.
I tried F5.
Yes. So Juha Luostarinen from Metener LTD.
Yeah, and also University of Jyväskylä.
Okay, I didn't know your background, so
Yeah.
but yes.
So maybe if I tell it, so you can
Yes.
hear it also.
Please, thank
So my
you.
name is Juha Luostarinen. I'm working part-time for Metener Limited and part-time for University of Jyväskylä. So actually, I just started working at the uni this month. So I've been around now 2.5 weeks back in the uni. So I've been in the companies previous 20 years. So my education background is in University of Jyväskylä. It was the Department of Environmental Science in the beginning of the millennia when I started studies. And then I worked in the research group of Professor Rintala, who is already emeritus. And we did mainly anaerobic digestion and landfill research and biological oxidation of methane on landfill top covers. So that is my like university background. Then I've been working at companies, mostly in AD, anaerobic digestion, for almost 20 years. And now I have done several research programs and research projects at company, but now we got this funding from Just Transitions Fund for new topics, and that funding is only open for like research organizations. So I switched back to university to do the research here and do the business in the company as usual. So I'm talking about anaerobic digestion and biological processes only. So I'm not expert in inorganic chemistry or things like that. I only know something about biological methods to convert the materials. So I heard that a lot of you have no biological background. You are from many faculties here. So I try to give a short introduction about what is the AD. So anaerobic digestion is a conversion, biological conversion technology for wet organic materials. So if you have some kind of a biological originating feedstock or waste, anaerobic digestion is a way to treat that waste into less harmful form. So for all organic material like biowaste, there is always a huge amount of water involved. I have some of the pictures in Finnish, sorry about that, but I didn't try to translate them on the go. So all the biological material contains a lot of water. Typically, materials used in the biogas process in the anaerobic digestion, they are synonyms. Is for example manure. The manure is many times in liquid form, and then it happens that there is 92% of water into the in the biomass in the waste, and the organic material is only like maybe 7%, and then there's 1% of ash. That is typical for the manures. If you take kitchen waste, bio waste, then you have water about 80% is water from the if you have apple peels and spent food that you are not eating, that contains also huge amount of water. And that makes that biogas inconvenient to burn in an incineration plant. But if you have a biological conversion, for example, composting or the anaerobic digestion, the water does not harm or it doesn't hinder the process as compared to burning. So this is for the wet biomasses. And after the biogas process, it's very good to understand that The end product still contains the water and the ash, but a lot of the organic material is converted into biogas. So that is always that you have the wet feedstock and also the wet end product. So that is very typical for the anaerobic digest. And it's for usually there are like three things that are good in the anaerobic digest, and that is the possibility to treat waste, produce green energy in the form of methane, and then also circulate the nutrients back into the agriculture. So those are the like three main drivers that we are going after. And recently there has been a lot of talk about the dry and wet fermentation and which is better, but it always should come from the feedstock with technology to use. So I'm not talking that much about that. But I say that the dry fermentation is when you have the high solid content in the reactor due to the low degradability of the feedstock. And this slide is about the biogas potential in Finland. And as we can see, this is the quite recent statistics, how many gigawatt hours of biogas is produced in Finland. That is about one terawatt hour. But how they have forecasted it is that the amount of manures and the agricultural residues are going to be increased in the AD production, like the forecast. So this is the current situation. This is the technically and economically viable potential, and this is the theoretical potential. So this is maybe what we could aim for, the techno-economical potential. But what is interesting to see that the bio-waste and the sewage sludge and a lot of the food industry waste is already treated, and also the landfill gas, those are all already utilized. But where the growth is going to be or is forecasted to be is the agrobiomass. So that is the energy crops, byproducts of cereal production, and also the manures from the animal husbandry. And nowadays, the agrobiomass is contribute only about 1% of the biogas production, but it's forecasted that it's going to be changing a lot. So if a lot of the renewable methane is going to be used, it has to be originated from the agro sector in the future, because almost all of the waste potential in the municipal waste and sewage sludge that is already used today. Then I have a few photographs of the biogas plants that are operated on agrobiomasses today. And one thing, if you are evaluating ever different biogas processes or actual biogas plants doing it, you should also always look at the volumetric gas production. I have found that very, very good figure to look at. So that is how many cubic meters of methane you get per volume of a cubic meter in the reactor per day. So that tells how efficient the process is and how efficiently the biogas is produced. So that is one figure to calculate when you are visiting or evaluating plants in the literature or in the site visits. And the dry batch fermentation is the topic we have mostly been involved in the last 7 or 6 years. So that is a lot of my personal interest, because typically the biogas reactor is always continuous stirred tank reactor. So where you mix the waste or the feedstock material and the microbes working in the biogas reactor all the time, you keep it constantly mixed with external mechanical energy. But I'm looking at the batch digestion. That means that you have the biomass in one place, do not agitate it at all, just circulate the liquids. And especially when you are having the very hard to utilize feedstock, so that is straw, hay, horse manure, and landscaping grass. It's very, very difficult to mix in the conventional process. So we have done it a bit differently in the batch processes. So we keep the biomass always in a constant place and only circulate the liquid that brings the microbes into the biomass. And the biomass produces some organic volatile fatty acids, soluble sugars into the liquid that is used in the liquid tank that produces methane and also increases the pH of the circulating liquid, and the circulating liquid is then pumped back into the biomass. And after a few rounds, the liquid has gone through the biomass. The conditions for the microbes that is used in the biomass producers start to multiply and live in the batch reactor also, and the biogas production starts in the batch as well. So that is what we have found most suitable way to treat the materials that are very difficult to treat in the conventional process. And in this kind of a process, you can have really long retention times because the straws and the grasses need quite a long retention time in order to digest properly, and that we can have a good yield of biogas. There is some examples of the different kind of plants it can, how it can look like. These are from Germany. It can be just like a swimming pool on the ground covered with the gas tight membrane, or they can be this kind of a garage type reactors. These are a few plants we have built in Finland by Methener, our company. And actually, this was the first plant we have built in utilizing this process. This is only 11 kilometers away in Lauko. And that kind of a silo, that is 720 cubic meters total volume, is filled only 3 or 4 times a year with new biomass. Then we digest the biomass on the place in the silo, empty it completely, and then put a new batch in. And we had this demonstration project with VTT a few years ago, where we started to inject hydrogen inside the biomass in order to convert that biologically into methane. Because the biogas typically has about 40% of CO2, that is not like wanted gas, and only 60% of CH4 methane, which is like the product that we want. That is due to the characteristics of feedstock. For example, if you have all organic material is always, it's carbohydrates, proteins, or fats. Something is always the biological material, even it's plant originated or mammal originated biomass. It's always those three categories that are carbohydrates, proteins, or fats. And especially with the plant material, the theoretical end product is 55% methane and 45% CO2. So there's excess of CO2. But by adding H2 into the process, we can stimulate the hydrogenotrophic methanogens to convert the CO2 into methane. And that is what we have done here in the demonstration project. And now the project that we got funded from JTF is that we are going to specify more what is happening in there and what would be the optimal process conditions for the biological methanization of hydrogen. This is even the most latest from previous year, and this year we started those plants, which are the biggest this far, digesting grass and straw. And there you can see how the biomass looks like after the digestion. So it's still very solid here, this kind of a process. And all this plant material is very porous and filled with those microbes that produce methane from acetic acid and carbon dioxide and hydrogen. And we introduce the hydrogen from the bottom of the biomass, and it slowly goes through the biomass, and on the way it converts into methane. A limiting factor this far is that if we inject the hydrogen into the process, the hydrogen molecule is very fast moving and easy to escape. So if we inject too much, the product gas that is released contains too much hydrogen, and we try to keep it below 1% volumetric, because that is the limit in the industrial standard for grid injection and vehicle use of methane. So it cannot go higher, otherwise it doesn't meet the quality standard. And that is one research topic we are going to address here in our project at the university, how to maximize the conversion and amount of hydrogen injected into the biomass without going over 1% of H2 in the product gas. This is very interesting product from the UK, especially aimed for the developing countries. So we do it mostly in this kind of a garage types or big halls, because there's a lot of snow in Finland and winter is very cold. But in the developing countries with the warm climate, they are doing it completely open without any building to protect the biogas reactor. The reactor can be just flat ground and huge amount of hay and grass, and then covered with gas-proof PVC plastic, and then inject the process liquid through the nozzles in the PVC. And the hydrogen boosting, why we are trying to do it inside the reactor, is that the investment is very low. You just have to have the hydrogen pipeline into the reactor. And because you have a low investment, then you can operate the hydrogen boosting only when the electricity price is feasible for the process. And I'm talking about hydrogen boosting because we really cannot reach the biomethane quality in situ. Inside the reactor, methanogenesis, there still needs some upgrading afterwards, but we can increase the methane power significantly. On the demonstration project, we learned that it's about 20 to 30% increase in the power without going above the 1% of residual H2. But what is not good about the in situ is that we get the biomethane, we still need to upgrade it a bit. And in the small scale, it's the problem that if you have an electrolyzer on the site, you have to pay electricity tax and transfer fees for the electricity you are using for the electrolysis. And also, there's economies of scale are not favorable of distributed hydrogen production, because the electrolyzer, bigger you buy, less it costs per kilowatt of power. But this is about to change. The biogas plants now get the lower electricity tax. It has changed just last year. It eases the operation. Electricity tax in Finland is 2.7 cents for normal users and industries. But if you are having a energy intensive or or this kind of a circular economy company. You can apply for lower tax, which is 0.2 cents per kilowatt hour. So that is a significant change. And biogas plants just recently moved under the lower tax. But still, there is the transfer fees for the small operators that are operating in the local electricity grids, not directly into the national grids like paper mills and really big industries. Some other companies do the ex-situ methanogenesis, and they claim to have the biomethane quality end product, so it would not need any polishing after the process. But you have to invest for the separate set of equipment if you want to do it externally, away from the biogas reactor itself. But the good thing here is that you can optimize the conditions for the microbes, because in the anaerobic digesters, all the microbes are working, different group of microbes, hydrolytic, fermentive, and acetoclastic, and hydrogenotroph methanogens. They all have slightly different process conditions that they find optimal. They all have to live in the one place. But in this kind of approach, when you treat the gas afterwards, you can optimize the process conditions just for the hydrogenotrophic methanogens, and you can forget what the other bugs like. But there is a lot of going on with the e-methane. There are also chemical or physical processes, how you can produce methane from electricity with the Sabatier process. Also, it's like bio-Sabatier, but the real Sabatier process is a bit more demanding of the pressures and the catalysts and the temperatures. I don't really know so much about that. I could talk about it, but that is the other options. And a lot of plants are under development in Finland also with bigger scale, because there is this legislation that requires that all the fuels have to be renewable. That is today, like about 10% of the fuels that you fill in the car must be renewable. But in 2027, the e-fuels are also going to be included in that legislation. So you need a biological fuel, but you have also need to have some fuel that is originated from electricity. So that's why the e-methane production is very feasible, because the legislation says that you have to have it, you have to buy it somewhere. So if you have the product, you definitely have the buyer for your product, and the price is going to be quite nice. So that's why a lot of the different companies are very active on the e-methane field. And I think the methane is the very simple molecule to produce synthetically or biologically component if you want to make diesel or gasoline from electricity. That is a bit more difficult than making methane from electricity. There's some electricity price charts. Today is just the same, that there is some hours that the electricity price is zero or negative, and sometimes it's peak high. So I see that the production of the e-methane should only happen on those hours, because those are also the hours when the carbon intensity in the electricity grid is lowest. The Finnish electricity market has most negatively priced hours of electricity in whole Europe. There was just week ago news about that. And that is because of the wind power and photovoltaic. In some hours, there is so much production that there is no consumption, so the price goes into zero or even less. Because the nuclear power plant, you cannot turn it off for a few hours, and they are even producing electricity that the price is negative. So we need to, a lot of the district heating companies are having electric boilers, several tens and hundreds of megawatts electric boilers to use electricity to heat the district heating water. But I think the hydrogen will be the next thing, more valuable thing, because if we are producing only heat with the electricity, the price for the other forms of heat is only about 40 hours per megawatt hour in the heat production. But if you are producing hydrogen, it can be easily reach like 100, 150 euros per megawatt hour. So I think that is the way how the market is developing. Yes, and now we have this Tutu project. It's called Tuplasti Tuottoa Turvemailta because the Just Transition Fund requires that it has something to do with the just transition of the beef producers giving away the production. So this is also this kind of what area politics involved, and a lot of the processes we are developing are suitable for rural areas and will bring employment to the rural areas. So that is why we are having this funding from Just the Transitions Fund. And now we did it quite backwards, that we first did the demonstration at the full-scale plant and saw that it's working. And now we are going into laboratory to investigate the optimal process conditions and what we could do more and what really happens in the microbiological consortia after we add the H2 in the process. Usually it goes that you do first the lab test and then you do the pilot and then you demonstrate and then you have the commercial unit, but we have the demonstration and then back to lab. Yes, that was about.
Yes, thank you.
As I said, if somebody is really interested in these topics and want to make a thesis about it, we are open for discussion.
Good to know. I think I at least have someone asking about master thesis projects. So
Yeah.
it's nice to know.
So there is in the project, there's Professor Tiilolaisen doing a tiny piece. I'm working half time here, and then I have a project worker full time. So we are quite a small group.
Yeah, Maria told me that you could present because I asked Maria first, but then she couldn't make it. So glad to have you talking about AD process. I've been working with the Natural Resources Institute Finland with the AD process. We produce volatile fatty acids
Yes.
in the process to be used in metal recovery.
Yeah.
Have you yourself done this volatile fatty acid process? Have you studied it, how to produce
Yeah,
this?
yes, but we try to keep it as low as possible because when there are low level of VFS, the process is working best for the methane production.
Yes, that's true.
But I already in 1990s they researched those volatile fatty acid production for in order to feed it at the wastewater treatment plant for the denitrification, was it? Because they use methanol and they wanted to have a bioproduct for that. So it's always, there's so many products involved in the process. You can do so many different things with the microbes.
Yeah, it's very versatile
Yeah.
and different feedstocks and
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, when I left university, there was this group researching how to produce hydrogen biologically. But I think because the electricity market has gone so volatile, there is no way that biological hydrogen would be competitive
Yeah.
to electrolysis. And that's why we are doing just opposite. We are trying to make hydrogen to methane, and
Yeah.
they were trying to use the
Yeah.
similar molecules to produce hydrogen.
Yeah, it goes, the research goes in like cycles,
Yeah.
and then you try to do a different thing, and then you notice, okay, it doesn't work, and then try a different.
Yeah, because what Manu told that the vast majority of the hydrogen today is produced with reforming natural gas. And the hydrogen you can buy today is not so free.
Yeah, any questions for you? I'm going to check the chat quickly to see if there's anything. Doesn't seem to be any questions, so thank you. Can I share your slide
Yes,
to
you
the board?
can. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And next Wednesday, we will have the next session. It's just only for if you have questions about the group work or essays or anything, I will be here to answer your questions if you need help or anything. Okay. See you Wednesday, perhaps. Okay, bye.
Okay.
Ei tainnut olla.
Joo. Joku aloittaa tänne, että on vielä saanut kieltä ennenkin.